So I'd like to welcome all of you here. Since I see so many new faces, let me introduce myself. I'm Florin Diacu, and I'm the UVic site director of the Pacific Institute for the Mathematical Sciences, which organizes this PIMS Distinguished Lecture Series. I'm very happy to introduce today to you Professor Robert L. Devaney from Boston University, who will talk about the Mandelbrot set, the fairy tree, and the Fibonacci sequence. He is a world-famous mathematician who did his PhD in 1973 with Stephen Smale and started in celestial mechanics, but after a few years with very successful results in the field, he switched topics and is working now in complex dynamics, especially on the Mandelbrot set. He is a well-known, a very good speaker. He gave over 1,000 talks up to now, and he just confessed to me that wherever he's invited at the university to give a talk, he's buying a mug. So we went to the bookstore and bought a mug, and he said that his collection includes now over 250 mugs. So, Bob, welcome, and I'd like to ask you to give us your presentation.
All right. Well, thank you for having me here. Let me turn the lights down. While I'm trying to do that, Florin tells me that not all of you are mathematicians. How many are not mathematicians? Oh, shit. isn't the engineering building over there? Okay. Well, I promise to go easy on you for the first 10 minutes. And after that, for the remaining 50 minus n, well, for 50 minus n minus 1, I'll talk to the mathematicians. And for the last minute, as is typical in mathematics, I'll talk just to myself. So what I'd like to tell you is some kind of amazing folk theorems about the Mandelbrot set. I'm sure most of you have seen, or at least I hope most of you have seen the famous image known as the Mandelbrot set. It's been known in mathematics since about 1980, studied exhaustively since then. We still don't understand it completely, even though it deals with just x squared plus c, that simple quadratic expression. What I'd like to tell you about today are three folk theorems that deal with the Mandelbrot set and the fairy tree and the Fibonacci sequence. I call them folk theorems because most people in complex dynamics, when you talk about these results, they say, oh, yeah, sure, I already know that. But, in fact, I really call them folk theorems because they're all false. Okay, one of them's about only 75% true. One of them's about 95% true. And one other is actually 99% true. But they're not all true. So my goal is really to show you how to actually make these statements true. That's where we'll get into the mathematics. So let me begin and go through these three folk theorems. First thing is, to deal with the Mandelbrot set, you're talking about complex iterations. You're going to start with the function z squared plus c. Both z and c are complex numbers, and you're going to iterate that function. Okay, what that means is you take z, the complex number, you compute its image, namely z squared plus c, and then you do it again. You apply the function q to q and so forth. You iterate that function over and over again. And then there are two important images that come out of this process. One is the Mandelbrot set, the picture you see here. That's a picture in the complex C plane. Remember, we're iterating z squared plus c. C is a parameter. Okay, the Mandelbrot set is the following. It's the set of c values for which you take the orbit of 0. You start with 0, compute 0 squared plus c, that's c, then c squared plus c, then that squared plus c, and so forth. You compute the orbit of 0, and the Mandelbrot set is the set of c values for which that orbit, that sequence of numbers, does not go to infinity. So if you choose a c value inside the Mandelbrot set, the orbit of 0, why 0, you ask, we'll see in a minute, why 0, the orbit of 0 does not go to infinity. Choose c outside the Mandelbrot set, the orbit of 0, in fact, goes to infinity. That's one important picture. The other important picture is what we call the Phil-Julia set. Okay, the Phil-Julia set is very different. It's a picture in the z-plane, in the c-d plane, not the c-plane. There's one Phil Julia set for each C value, and what that Phil Julia set is fix the C and look at all those Z's for which you compute the orbit of Z, and that orbit does not go to infinity. Okay, so it's all those Z values for which the orbit stays bounded. Okay, and there's a different Phil Julia set for each different C. Now, I'm going to be interested for these folk theorems in what are known as the P over Q bulbs. Okay, the P over Q bulbs are, roughly speaking, these bulbs you see attached to this large cardioid region in the Mandelbrot set. Okay, I'll tell you specifically what I mean by P over Q in a minute, but first of all, if you look at the Mandelbrot set, you can check pretty easily that if you choose a C inside this large cardioid region, then Z squared plus C has a fixed point, okay, which is attracting. You can solve for that fixed point pretty easily, Z squared plus C equals Z, and then you take its derivative and see that derivative is less than 1 in absolute value, so that's an attracting fixed point. So the cardioid is the place where the Z squared plus C is an attracting fixed point. These P over Q bulbs that I've shaded in violet here are the places where the quadratic function has an attracting what I call P over Q cycle. Okay, it's a cycle of period Q that's attracting. You'll see that in a minute. So what happens is if you run around the Mandelbrot set, let your C vary, then if C is inside that main cardioid, you see all orbits tend to one attracting fixed point. On the other hand, as soon as you go into the P over Q bulb, all of a sudden you've got a Q cycle that's attracting, so orbits tend to that Q cycle. And I'll show you that dynamically in a minute. In any event, you see that we get a bifurcation, a change, as you go out of the cardioid into one of these bulbs. Something different happens to orbits. Specifically, what happens mathematically is if you're in the cardioid, you have one attracting fixed point, all orbits are tending to it, and running around that attracting fixed point is a repelling cycle, a cycle of period Q that actually runs around. You don't see that on the computer. And now as C leaves the cardioid, hits the boundary and enters the P over Q bulb, what happens is this repelling P over Q cycle comes down and kisses the attracting fixed point, making it what we call neutral. Okay, and then as soon as you enter the P over Q bulb, it reappears, but now the stability has been exchanged. Now all of a sudden that attracting cycle, that cycle has become attracting, and meanwhile the fixed point has ceased to be attracting and has become repelling. Let me actually show you that little dynamically here. What I'm going to do is run the cursor around the interior of the Mandelbrot set and then display up in this little black screen here the fate of typical orbits. Okay, so for example, if I let C run around the cardioid, what you see in that upper left-hand screen, hopefully, is just one point. What is that one point? That's the attracting fixed point. In fact, what I'm doing here is looking at the fate of the orbit of zero and seeing where it goes. So for C in the cardioid, the orbit of zero goes to one fixed point. On the other hand, as soon as I enter one of these bulbs, then all of a sudden, you see two points there? What I'm actually doing is computing 50 points on the orbit and circling the 50th. That's why you actually see 50 points there. Right, but they're all clumped together in a cycle of period 2, and I'm circling the 50th one with me, so that I'm inside a bulb where I have an attracting cycle of period 2. Back in here, I have an attracting cycle of period 1. If I go north, I enter this region where the orbit of 0 tends to a cycle of period 3. Very good. So you can see that far. Can you see that far from and back? Or can you count that high? Maybe that's whatever. Okay, period 3. That's actually the 1/3 bulb. If I go over here in this bulb, see the orbit of 0 tends to a cycle of period 4. That's actually the 1/4 bulb. Okay, over here there's another bulb. The orbit of 0 tends to a cycle, if you can see them all, of period 5. And that happens for each of these bulbs. Inside this little bulb here, If you can count that high, actually, if you can distinguish the points in the shade, there's actually 7 points there. The orbit of zero tends to a cycle of period 7. That's actually the 2/7th bulb. If I leave the Mandelbrot set, then by definition, the orbit of zero goes off to infinity. Come back in, at least to the interior, I'm attracted to a cycle of some period. Okay? Well, actually, there's more to the story than just the orbit of zero tends to a cycle or a fixed point. Actually, those Phil-Julia sets change as well. Okay, let me show you that. Okay, here's an animation of what happens as I let C run out the boundary of the Mandelbrot, the cardioid, and into the 1/2 bulb. Okay, what I'll display over here is the so-called Phil-Julia set for each C value. Remember, Phil-Julia set is the set of seeds whose orbits do not escape to infinity, and I paint them in black. So the Phil-Julia set corresponding to this C value is all those points in a complex plane painted black here. In the middle, you see the attracting fixed point, right? That's because C is chosen in the cardioid. With me so far? Okay, non-mathematicians? All the mathematicians said, yeah. Okay. Well, so let's watch what happens to not only that attracting fixed point, but also the Phil-Julia set as I let C enter the 1/2 bulb. What you see is suddenly there's a change. In fact, that attracting fixed point has become repelling, spewed off a cycle of period 2, and all these black points actually tend to that cycle of period 2. All the colored points go off to infinity. But notice what happened to the Phil-Julia set. It's pinched in infinitely many pieces exactly when I leave the cardioid. Right there, we get the bifurcation. Attracting cycle of period 2 is born, and meanwhile, that Phil-Julia set pinches into some complicated fractal set. Let me show you one more of those. Let me show you what happens when we go into the 1/4 bulb. Okay, the 1/4 bulb is this bulb right here. I'm starting actually at C in the cardioid. The Phil-Julia set is a big black blob, a big black disk. But that changes when we enter the 1/4 bulb. Again, suddenly you see the birth of an attracting cycle of period 4. Meanwhile, the fixed point becomes repelling. And meanwhile, that Phil-Julia set pinches in all sorts of places. Okay? Exactly at the bifurcation point where the change happens, the Phil-Julia set becomes topologically much more interesting. One last one. Now I'll enter the 2/5 bulb. As C enters the 2/5 bulb, suddenly, again, we get the birth of an attracting cycle of period 4, and meanwhile, the Phil-Julia set changes its topological shape. Okay, good. All right, well, I'm heading toward the first of these folk theorems, but before I do, I need to tell you one more thing that's actually well-known and easy to prove. If C is on the boundary of the cardioid, then you can check very easily that the function QC, z squared plus C, has a fixed point that's neutral. Okay, if it's inside the cardioid, the fixed point is attracting. If it's outside, the fixed point is repelling, which means derivative either less than 1 or bigger than 1. On the cardioid, the derivative has an absolute value equal to 1, which means it's of the form e to the 2 pi I theta. So as C runs around the boundary of the cardioid, the derivative changes on the unit circle. It's a number of the form e to the 2 pi I theta. And in fact, what happens as C varies, as C winds once around the boundary of the cardioid, e to the 2 pi I theta winds once around the unit circle. Okay, so that means that 2 pi I theta goes through all the rational angles exactly once as C runs around the boundary of the cardioid. And again, this is a straightforward computation. And it's precisely when theta is a rational number that one of these P over Q bulbs emerges. For example, down here, theta is 0. We run through theta equals 1/4. Theta equals 1/3, that's where the 1/3 bulb emerges. theta equals 2/5, that's where the 2/5 bulb emerges, etc. So at a dense set of points around the boundary of the cardioid, we have one of these bulbs attached, and each of those bulbs has a name. It's a name theta for a rational number. That rational number increases as we run around the boundary of the cardioid. So in particular, the names of the bulbs go like so. Right, the P over Q bulbs are arranged in the exact order of the rational numbers. Okay, theta equals 1/4 is here, theta equals 1/3, theta is 2/5, 3/7, etc. Okay, again, if you're not an expert in the field, you've never seen this before, but I have my undergraduates prove that. Okay, so here's folk theorem number one. Okay, here's folk theorem number one. Looks kind of complicated, but I'll illustrate it graphically in a minute. What it basically says is, if you give me the Phil-Julia set for a C value inside one of these P over Q bulbs, then I can read off P over Q. I can just look at that Phil-Julia set and tell you which bulb I came from. And here's the way. It turns out if you look at that Phil-Julia set, it's pinched in a lot of places. If you pull out the repelling fixed point, if you pull out that repelling fixed point, the Phil-Julia set degenerates to a finite number of pieces, and it turns out that zero lies in the largest piece, whereas the image of zero, zero squared plus C, C, lies in the smallest component. So if I know where zero is, and I know where C is, then I can read off what P over Q is, because Q of C, Q sub C of zero, lies in the smallest component, which is located P over Q turns in the counterclockwise direction. Okay, sounds like a bunch of bull, but let me show you what it means in terms of the pictures. Okay, whoop, wrong place. There we go. All right. Okay, so let me first look inside the what I call the 1/3 bulb. Okay, that's a magnification of the 1/3 bulb in the Mandelbrot set. Let me now choose a C value inside that 1/3 bulb and display two things, the orbit, the attracting cycle, okay, the attracting 3 cycle, and the Phil-Julia set. Okay, and the claim is you should be able to read off 1/3 in two different ways. The first way is with the cycle. Right? Remember, there's a repelling fixed point right smack in the middle there. Okay, this is what we call the fractal rabbit, by the way. Here's the main body of the rabbit. Okay, like all good rabbits, it has 2 ears, but it's fractal because it has ears on top of ears on top of ears everywhere you look. But if you pull out the eyeball of the rabbit, it decomposes into 3 pieces. And notice that the cycle runs around those 3 pieces and does so by rotating 1/3 of a turn at each iteration. See that here? 1/3 of a turn in the counterclockwise direction, 1/3, 1/3, etc. So you can read off 1/3 just by the behavior of the cycle. But you can also read off 1/3 by looking at the Phil-Julia set. Okay, this fractal rabbit decomposes into 3 pieces. The largest piece is the one that I've highlighted here, right? It contains zero because this Phil-Julia set is symmetric about zero. And the smallest piece is located right there. The smallest piece is located 1/3 of a turn in the counterclockwise direction. The next smallest is located another 1/3 of a turn, and then another 1/3 of a turn. So you can actually read off 1/3 by looking at the Phil-Julia set. The largest piece contains zero. Okay, the smallest piece contains the image of zero, and in this case, it's located 1/3 of a turn in the counterclockwise direction. You give another example of that. This turns out to be the 1/4 bulb. Okay, and we can read that off again by choosing a C value in the bulb, displaying the cycle of period 4. Notice that it rotates by 1/4 of a turn in the counterclockwise direction each time I iterate. And notice that the Phil-Julia set says 1/3, 1/4 as well. because there's the largest piece of the Phil Julia set containing zero. Where's the smallest piece? Well, the smallest piece is right there, located again, 1/4 of a turn in a counterclockwise direction. Next smallest, and largest. Okay, so that Phil Julia set comes from the 1/4 bulb. One more example. This bulb turns out to be the 2/5 bulb. And again, you can see that in several ways, right? Notice that the cycle is bouncing around, rotating by 2/5 of a turn each time you iterate. And forget about the cycle. Look at the Phil Julia set. Where is the smallest ear on this Phil Julia set? Now, zero is located right here. The smallest ear is clearly right there, and that's located 1/5, 2/5 of a turn from zero. So you can look at this Phil Julia set and read off 2/5. I can see that some of you are having problems here, so it's time for a quiz. Okay. We copied these transparencies, and I forgot to put the quizzes back. So, quiz number one. From which bulb does that filled Julia set come from? You don't need to see the numbers. That's not going to help you. You want me to turn it over? Okay. How's that? Just that C isn't going to help you any, unless you really know the Mandelbrot set. It's always interesting seeing mathematicians try to count to 7. How many think this is the something 6th bulb? Don't forget to count this one. This is actually the 3/7 bulb. If you look at that junction point, there's actually 7 blobs attached. The symmetric one, 0, is right here. The smallest is located 1/2, 3/7 of a turn. With me, so I can just look at that Phil Julia set and read off 3/7. With me? Okay, well, that's folk theorem number one. That's a pretty good one. That's about 95% true. Here's folk theorem number two. Okay, this is the one that's a little less important. This one's only about 75% true, though I'm going to make it true, completely true in a minute. Okay, folk theorem number two basically says you can look at the bulb in the Mandelbrot set and read off P over Q. Okay, you can look at the bulb in the Mandelbrot set and tell exactly that you're in the P over Q bulb. And here's how you do it. If you look at the P over Q bulb, it's going to have an antenna with exactly Q spokes emanating from it. Exactly Q spokes. Okay, and it turns out that the smallest spoke is located exactly P over Q turns from the what we call the principal spoke in the counterclockwise direction. Let me show you what I mean by that. Here's a bulb in the Mandelbrot set. Okay, it's kind of hard to see, but there's actually a long, thin filament of black that runs through this blue region here. That's why I use this shading. Red goes to orange, to yellow, to green, to blue, to violet. There's a long, thin filament of black that you can't see in the Mandelbrot set. That's the antenna. That antenna has a junction point right about there, and there's exactly 3 spokes emanating from it. Exactly 3 spokes emanating from it. Now, what I call a principal spoke is this spoke right here. And where is the shortest spoke on the Mandelbrot set?
We're getting back to the
non-mathematicians. We're getting back. Yeah, right. Yeah, sorry. Okay. The shortest spoke, well, there's the longest spoke. The shortest spoke is the one over here, and that's located 1/3 of a turn in the counterclockwise direction. With me? So you just look at that bulb and say that's the 1/3 bulb, and then check it by choosing a C value and displaying the cycle of period 3. You read off 1/3 that way. Displaying the rabbit, you read the smallest ear is located 1/3 of a turn. Another example. How about this one? Well, now you see the antenna a little bit better. There's the junction point. There are 5 spokes coming out of the junction point. There's the principal spoke leading down to the bulb. Where is the shortest spoke? The shortest spoke is located not here, but here, in fact, two-fifths of a turn in the counterclockwise direction. So this should have been the two-fifths bulb, and in fact, if you look at the Phil-Julia set, for the cycle of period five, you read off two-fifths in both of those ways. One more example. What's that bulb? I'm going to give you a quiz, I guess. That bulb is the 3/7 bulb. All right, very good. Okay, and you check that by looking at the Phil-Julia set, which was the quiz I just gave you a minute ago. All right, the cycle of period 7 is jumping 3/7 each time you iterate, and the smallest ear seems to be located, well, here's the main body, the smallest ear is located 1/2-3/7 of a turn around. Good. Well, time for quiz. You had trouble with 7? Yeah, I know, God. So what's that bulb? 12? Very good. You can't be a mathematician if you can count to 12. Are you? Oh, okay. Oh, geez. Wow, a mathematician.
How long is this book?
Well, it's infinitely. I mean, okay, we're going to come back. Now the mathematicians are talking. Yeah, this is the 5/12. Here's the principle. So 1, 2, 3, 4. The shortest is right there. It's 5/12 of a turn. Okay. So the question is, you know, how long is a spoke? In fact, that's why these things are folk theorems. I'm saying, well, the smallest spoke, the biggest ear. What do I mean by smallest and biggest? In fact, each of these spokes are infinitely long. So I've got to make precise what I mean by smallest and largest. But it's amazing that you can just sort of sit there and look at that piece of the Mandelbrot and say, oh, I know, that's the 5/12 bulb. And in fact, I know what the Julia sets look like if I pull it from here. And I know what that cycle of period 12 is going to be doing. Incidentally, this shows you that the Mandelbrot set is the antithesis of a fractal. Most people think that it's named after Mandelbrot, therefore it should be a fractal. But in fact, everywhere you look in this Mandelbrot set is completely different. Okay, and as just what I'm showing here, you just look at this bulb and tell exactly where you are. In fact, that's true of any of these bulbs. Every one of them is completely different. And with a little course in complex dynamics, you can tell exactly where you are if you magnify that little piece. It's the antithesis of a self-similar set. Okay, let me move to folk theorem number 3. This is my favorite one. This one involves the fairy tree. Okay, let me remind you what the fairy tree is. The fairy tree is a list of all the rationals, let's just say in the unit interval, all the fractions in the unit interval. Okay, it's determined recursively. If you haven't seen this before, what you do is at some finite stage, you're going to have a finite list of rationals, and any two adjacent rationals are called fairy neighbors. Okay, so we're going to start with the two endpoints, 0 and 1, which I choose to write as 0 over 1 and 1 over 1. Okay, so at the first stage of the fairy tree, they're fairy neighbors. Whenever you have fairy neighbors, they immediately become fairy parents, okay, and they produce a fairy child. Okay, and the fairy child, in this case, is a rational in between. So I've got to tell you how they produce the fairy child. There's two ways of doing that. One way is you add the fractions just the way you always wanted to, right? By that, I mean you add the numerators and you add the denominators. Some people out in the back aren't laughing, so you add the numerators and you add the denominators. That's one way to produce the fairy child. The mathematical way is the fairy child is the fraction between the fairy parents whose denominator is the smallest. And it's amazing that this sort of crazy relationship produces that fraction. For example, here's the fairy tree. Right? We start with fairy parents 0 over 1 and 1 over 1 produce 1/2. Then the fairy parents get together with the fairy child and produce, fairy grandchildren. Okay, 0 over 1 plus 1/2 is 1/3. 1 over 1 plus 1/2 is 2/3. Then the fairy parents, children, and grandchildren get together. And the whole thing is pretty disgusting, but they produce, I mean, well, I'm from the U.S. A lot of Bill Clinton jokes came up around here, but anyway, we won't use them, whatever. So they take one half and two thirds. The fairy child between one half and two thirds is three fifths, right, is three fifths. And that's this fraction with the smallest denominator between one half and two thirds. There's no fourths between one half and two thirds. And you continue in this thing, right? Next stage, you produce new fairy children, etc. It's a fact that you produce all fractions in this way. And this goes back to fairy in the turn of the 17th century, actually. Okay, here's folk theorem number three. Excuse me. Folk theorem number three says, give me two fairy neighbors, okay, alpha over beta and gamma over delta. Then they correspond to two bulbs in the Mandelbrot set. Okay, now which is the largest bulb between these fairy parents? Well, it turns out that the largest bulb between alpha over beta and gamma over delta is the bulb corresponding to the fairy child. You add the numerators and you add the denominators. Okay, in fact, this is a pretty good folk theorem. It's 99.9% true. In fact, I've never seen a counterexample to it. It's always true. Let me illustrate that for you. Where is it? Ah, good, sorry. Question? Or? Okay, so let me show you this. Turns out that this is the one-half bulb, and this up here we saw was the one-third bulb. So the largest bulb in between should be this one, and that should be the two-fifths bulb. And in fact, we've seen that. All right, if I zoom in on those two things, on the left you see the one-half bulb, on the top you see the one-third bulb, and the largest bulb in between is right here. Of course, for the mathematicians, what do I mean by largest? And I'll make that precise in a second. And that, if you read the antenna, is the two-fifths bulb. So there's the two-fifths bulb and the one-third bulb. So let me zoom in on the region between them. On the left, you see two-fifths. On the right, you see one-third. This guy right here is clearly the largest bulb in between. That should be two-fifths plus one-third is three-eighths. Right? You always worry about that. At least in the U.S., you worry that a dean will be running by when you say two-fifths plus one-third is three-eighths. Right? Fire the math. Of course, the dean probably has no idea that that's not true, but in any event. So let me zoom in there. There you see now the two-fifths. Right? There you see the two-fifths clearly here. If you count the spokes here, you see three-eighths. Okay, so there's three-eighths, there's two-fifths. Largest bulb in between should be the five-thirteenths, right? There's three-eighths. Way down here is two-fifths. This bulb should be the five-thirteenths. In fact, if I go in further, you'll see that that's the five-thirteenths. If you count the spokes there, there's 13 of them, right? And in the counterclockwise direction, the shortest spoke is located five-thirteenths of a turn around. It's amazing that this works. But it does. So there's 5/13. Over on the left was 3/8. So that should be 8/21. And it's kind of hard in this resolution to see it. But if you look, that's the 8/21 bulb. Okay. So, and this goes on as deep as you want. You can read off the period, that fraction, from each of these bulbs in the Mandelbrot set. So as I said earlier, the Mandelbrot set is the antithesis of a fractal because you can actually see and understand where you are no matter how deeply you go into it. By the way, did you see the that sequence I just showed you? That sequence I just showed you referred to one part of the talk. Right? I went from one-half to one-third, add the numerators and denominators, get two-fifths. Two-fifths and one-third was three-eighths, five-thirteenths, 8/21. If you see, the numerators there form the Fibonacci sequence. So it's actually zooming in according to the rule of the Fibonacci sequence. And in fact, what happens is if you keep taking these bulbs, parents, child, new child, grandchild, great-grandchild, etc., these bulbs are converging down to a point in the Mandelbrot set, actually a point in the boundary of the cardioid. It doesn't converge to a bulb. That point is actually a theta value where the derivative is irrational. In fact, it's related to the golden number. Okay, understanding what's happening at the limit of this sequence is something that Yacouz won the Fields Medal for 6 years ago. Okay, that's where you get a so-called Siegel disk, understanding the dynamics of x squared plus c in the limit of the sequence of these bulbs at that irrational point was just done in the last 6 or 7 years. In fact, we only understand the behavior of the x squared plus c along the boundary at c values for which the derivative is e to the 2 pi I theta, where theta is highly irrational. And, of course, the golden number is the most irrational of numbers. So only where the derivative is a highly irrational rotation. If it's rational, okay, or no, if it's rational, we understand it. If it's highly irrational, if we understand it. If it's not so irrational, if it's close to rational numbers, then we have no idea what's happening to z squared plus c near there. Okay. So for the what do you mean by highly irrational? You know, find a number theorist, slam them up against the wall, and they'll talk to you for hours about highly irrational numbers. All right. So let me close by just trying to briefly explain how we make all of these results true. Okay, each of these folk theorems involved largest to smallest. Smallest spoke, largest ear, etc. What do we mean by large or small? Well, it's basically a job for the Riemann mapping theorem, because some wonderful work of Douady and Hubbard about 15 years ago says that there's actually an analytic homeomorphism that takes the exterior of the unit circle, that takes the exterior of the unit circle to the exterior of the Mandelbrot set. Okay, for those of you in mathematics, it's actually the exterior Riemann mapping theorem, taking infinity in the Riemann sphere to infinity in the Riemann sphere here. So in particular, under this homeomorphism, if you give me any straight ray, its image is a curve that at least accumulates on the boundary of the Mandelbrot set. One of the main open problems is, do all of these rays actually limit on a point in the Mandelbrot set? That's not solved yet. We're almost there. If that's solved, then we understand the Mandelbrot set completely. In any event, if you take the straight ray and look at its image, that image is what we call an external ray. Now, here's the idea. Here's the idea of how we measure the size of these structures. For example, the size of the P over Q bulb. Okay, what we'll do is, turns out that there's two rays that limit on the so-called root point of the P over Q bulb, where that P over Q bulb is joined to the main cardioid. I'll call them S minus, the lower ray, and S plus, the upper ray. So there's two rays that limit on the root point of each P over Q bulb. That means that any ray in between S plus and S minus must actually accumulate somewhere on the P over Q bulb. So the idea is to measure the size of those bulbs by the length of the interval of rays that actually accumulates on one of these bulbs. And here in a caricature, I've shown you the two rays that come into the one-third bulb. All the other rays in between accumulated, and the length, the interval of those rays, seems to be larger than the length of the interval of rays that lands on the one-fifth bulb. So that's how we'll make precise the size of these bulbs. The largeness of these bulbs is simply the length of the interval of rays, the arc of rays, if you will, that accumulates on that particular structure. Okay, so the only question is, how would you ever compute the length of these rays? Okay, for those of you who are complex analysts, you know that you're never going to be able to compute what happens under a Riemann map. But the amazing thing is, despite the fact that the boundary of this set is so complicated, the fact is you can compute what happens to these rays, specifically the rays S minus and S plus of P over Q. You can compute exactly what they are. is here's the fact, here's the main fact that I'm going to use. The fact is that if you give me the P over Q bulb, okay, then it's going to have two rays that come to it, S minus and S plus. Okay, those numbers are actually rational numbers. And those numbers, okay, the angles that come to the root point, actually have period Q under doubling mod 1. Okay, what that means is if you give me P over Q and ask me which rays come down, I only have to find the numbers, the rational numbers, which when I keep doubling them mod 1, I actually get a point of period Q. So, for example, what are the rays that land at the 1/2 bulb? What are the two rays that come in, one S plus and the other S minus, that land at this root point here? That's the 1/2 bulb. The denominator is 2. So those two rays must have period 2 under doubling mod 1, and you can figure out what those numbers are. Right? They've got to be 1/3 and 2/3. Because if you take 1/3 and double it, you get 2/3. If you take 2/3 and double it, you get 4/3 or 1/3 mod 1. Right? So 1/3 and 2/3 have period 2 under doubling. Those are the only numbers that have period 2 under doubling. So those must be the rays. So the rays that come in to the 1/2 bulb are 1/3 and 2/3. So the length, the size, if you will, of the 1/2 bulb is this ray is 1/3, that ray is 2/3. The difference is 1/3. This size is 1/3. Another example, take the numbers 1/7, 2/7, etc., the sevenths. They all have period 3 under doubling. Because 1/7 doubles to 2/7, doubles to 4/7, doubles to 1/7 mod 1. So these have period 3 under doubling, as do 3/7, 6/7, 5/7. So the sevenths, the fractions, the sevenths, must all land at bulbs that have period 3 in the Mandelbrot set. And similarly, the ones with denominator 2 to the 4th minus 1, like the 15ths, all have period 4. 1/15 doubles to 2/15, to 4/15, to 8/15, doubles to 16/15, so period 4 under doubling. So those numbers must be rays that land at period 4 bulbs. So this says that you effectively have a fairly difficult algorithm, for determining which rays land at the root points of bulbs. We saw that what I've done is I've sort of indexed the rays, mod 1, around the boundary of the Mandelbrot set. 0, it turns out by symmetry, goes right into the mouth of the Mandelbrot set. A lot of people ask me why I call that the mouth of the Mandelbrot set, but we won't get into that. And by symmetry, 1/2 goes to the tail of the Mandelbrot set. Okay. And 1/3, we saw, that has period 2 under doubling, so that's got to come down to the period 2 bulb. And 2/3 has period 2 under doubling, so that must go to the period 2 bulb. Okay, what bulbs must go to the period 3 bulb? Well, we saw that the sevenths have period 3 under doubling. So there's actually, let's see, there's 1/7 here and there's 2/7 here. Those are the only sevenths in that region. The Riemann map is a homeomorphism, so these rays can't cross. So the 2/7 bulb must go here and the 1/7 bulb must go there. No other possibility. And so forth. 5/7 and 6/7, you can see those rays. They have period 3 under doubling. They must go to a period 3 bulb. And luckily, there's the 2/3 bulb right here. So 5/7 and 6/7 have to go in there. Finally, there's 3/7 and 4/7 out here. They've got to go to a period 3 bulb. Well, there's no period 3 bulb hanging off the cardioid out there. But if you know anything about the Mandelbrot set, you know there's lots of little baby Mandelbrot sets in it. There's one right here that you can see. Actually, that's a baby Mandelbrot set whose cardioid has period not 1 like the main cardioid, but actually period 3. So 3/7 and 4/7 must go to it. And the story just continues. 1/15 and 2/15 have period 4 under doubling. 1/15 goes to 2/15, to 4/15, to 8/15, to 1/15. So these two rays must limit on a period 4 bulb, and sure enough, there's one exactly right there. 1/15 and 2/15 must go exactly to that period 4. Hey, it's a conformal map, right? And so forth. 1/5 is 3/15. 4/15, they also have period 4. So somewhere in the Mandelbrot set, there's got to be a period 4 bulb between this, hanging off this period 3 component. In fact, if you know anything about the Mandelbrot set, you know that right about there, there's a baby Mandelbrot set whose cusp, whose main cardioid actually has period 4. There has to be one there because we've got period 4 rays. So somehow, despite the complexity of how this is arranged, it's all ordered exactly according to the rational numbers, exactly according to the rational numbers. Now, okay, the problem is if you give me the bulb, the 731 over 1,468 bulb, it's there. Ask me to find the rays that come to it, find the rays to come to it. It's by this procedure, it's going to be exhausting, right? I'm going to take the period 3, the period 4, the period 5 rays in order to get to the period 2000-something. It's going to take me a while. So there is, in fact, what I was going to talk about is an algorithm to determine those rays. You give me P over Q, and I can tell you exactly where those, what rays land at the P over Q bulb. Given the fact that most of us are not yet mathematicians, though I'm sure that will change pretty soon. Let me not give you that algorithm. Let me, in fact, just tell you the following fact. It sort of begins to be apparent from here. If you look at the period 3 bulb, yeah, if you look at the period 2 bulb, right, the rays that land on it are the numbers between 1/3 and 2/3, so the length of the arc of rays that land on the period 2 bulb is, well, it's 1/3, right? 1/3, or 1 over 2 squared minus 1. The length of this arc of rays that lands on the period 2 bulb is 1/3, or 1 over 2 squared minus 1. And the length of the arc of rays that lands on the 1/3 bulb is, now, this ray, the upper ray is 6/7, the lower ray is 5/7, the difference is 1/7, which I write as 1 over 2 cubed minus 1. All right, same thing here. If you look at the center, is that right? I'm sorry? Somebody? 1 over 2 cubed minus 1 is 1/7. Okay, good. Same thing up here. The length of the rays that lands on the period 3 bulb up here is also 1/7, 1 over 2 cubed minus 1. Right? In fact, the length of the rays that land on this period 4 bulb is 1 over 2 to the 4th minus 1. And now you can make a conjecture about what the length of the rays that land at the P over Q bulb is. If that's the P over Q bulb, the length of the arc of rays that lands there is precisely 1 over 2 to the Q minus 1. And how you prove that is very easy. You just use this algorithm to actually do that, which I will spare you the details. So now, for example, given that, let me jump ahead a bit, given that, the length of the arc of rays that land at the P over Q bulb is precisely 1 over 2 to the Q minus 1. Okay, now do you see how to prove, for example, Folk Theorem number 3? Right? To prove Folk Theorem number 3, remember what that was? You got two fairy parents, alpha over beta and beta over gamma. They produce a fairy child, right, whose numerator is the sum alpha plus gamma, and whose denominator is beta plus delta. Okay, and the claim is that that was the largest bulb between these two bulbs. Why is that? Well, remember what largest means. Largest means it attracts the most number of rays. Okay, so the P over Q bulb, according to this algorithm, attracts the length of rays 1 over 2 to the Q minus 1. Right? But remember, P over Q is the fraction between the parents whose denominator is the smallest. So if you've got any other fraction, say X over Y, between the parents, then their denominator is larger, its denominator is larger, so the length of the rays that land on the X over Y bulb is 1 over 2 to the Y minus 1, which is smaller. All right? So between any two bulbs, the largest one, both visually and in terms of the number of rays, is precisely the bulb that corresponds to the fairy child. And in a similar fashion, you can prove the size of the ears of the Julia sect. You can prove the size of the length of the spokes of the antennas in the Mandelbrot set. It all comes down to some fairly simple arithmetic, given the fact that you have an algorithm for determining where these rays lie. Given the fact that we're not all mathematicians, and given the fact that I'm 2 minutes over, I won't prove that for you. So maybe I'll stop there. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bob, for your nice talk. So if there are questions, please.
Yes.
So take the worst case was 75% true. In this case, you have computer visualizations which occasionally don't agree.
Yeah, let me actually show you that. That's probably a good idea, yeah. Let's look at a couple more. Oops, sorry. Well, here, no, let's actually compute a couple of these bulbs. Way down here, let's see, this is the... You can actually read it off. This will be the 1/3, the 1/4, the 1/5, and the 1/6 bulb, okay? So let's try to compute that 1/6 bulb and see what it looks like. I don't have that stored. Okay. So that should be the 1/6 bulb. Here's the junction point, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Oh, that's the 1/7 bulb. Is that the 1/7 bulb? Well, the shortest spoke seems to be here. Is it? No, that's the shortest spoke. That's actually the shortest spoke in terms of the length of rays. When I'm over in this area of the Mandelbrot set, near the mouth of the Mandelbrot set, I tend to look at where the largest ray is. Okay, so over in this region of the Mandelbrot set, you look at where the largest ray is. And if we magnify that bulb there, you see that the largest ray, the largest spoke, rather, is located 1/7 of a turn in the clockwise direction. So if I went in a counterclockwise, the theorem is clearly false. So the real theorem is you need sort of hyperbolic eyeglasses to read off what these spokes are, which is the longest. I actually sell hyperbolic eyeglasses if you want to buy a pair. So in this region of the Mandelbrot set, you use the largest spoke, and then you can read off 1/7.
Whereabouts does that break down?
What's that?
Whereabouts is the boundary before that?
Right at 1/4, actually. 1/4 is right here. And here's the... So here's the spoke junction point, four spokes coming out. Is this one the longest or is that one the longest? Debatable. It's fairly close. This was actually the shortest in terms of the rays. I think I said longest. I meant shortest. Right? In fact, in the counterclockwise direction, this should be the shortest if the theorem were true visually. Now, it's not clear whether this is the shortest or that is, but it is clear that this is the longest. So over on this side, I'd be going 1/4 in that direction. Okay, so it's right around 1/4 where the theorem breaks down. So that's about 25% of the Mandelbrot set, if you look in terms of you know, the length, the arc here. So that's what I'm saying. So you can't take the, but it's kind of amazing that you can, well, what we're really doing is computing for the mathematician's conformal measure on the boundary of the Mandelbrot set. This Riemann map is landing in the boundary. You get conformal measure here, and I'm estimating conformal measure. It's amazing that conformal measure conforms to visual measure. That generally doesn't happen, especially since the boundary of this set has been proved to be, well, the Mandelbrot set is two-dimensional. Its boundary should be one-dimensional. Well, no, it isn't. The boundary of the Mandelbrot set has Hausdorff dimension 2, as large as it can be. So this boundary is getting incredibly wild as you get in there. Okay, if that's the case, then what we know as conformal measure should have nothing to do with your eyeballs. But it's amazing that, it, at least in terms of the bulbs, it does. You can read off the conformal measure of the boundary. That's I think, the interest here mathematically. Want to go back to engineering? I'm sorry, I can't hear because of the projector.
How good does your arithmetic have to be before your visual imagery has anything to do with reality?
You mean the computation of these things? Well, obviously, once I get into bulbs of period 2000, right, the size is 1 over 2 to the 2000. I mean, it's getting pretty small. So once you're there, you have no visual reality, at least not yet, until you guys build better machines, right? Then presumably, well, then we don't need the visual reality because we have a theorem that proves it.
Second question. Has there been any effort to make direct calculations of what's
What's in it?
Sure.
I think what you're asking is how big it is, the volume, the... No?
Well, no. I suppose that you can start by writing the equation for the cardioid.
Yes.
Right. And similarly, when you identify these bulbs, you can write measures.
Yes.
So now...
They have period... Their exponent, their power, their degree goes up like... Q to the Q squared, I think. Whatever.
Sure. How do you raise it?
Q to the Q. Whatever. It goes up very fast, yeah.
That's just the number. The degree is coming.
The degree, I'm sorry, the degree of the map of the boundary is 2 to the Q. 2 to the Q, yeah. So the writing those, but that's, see, I've been keying in on these guys here, but this same algorithm works everywhere else. And everywhere else means you've got infinitely many of these baby Mandelbrot sets everywhere you look. And it works there as well. But there's much more than just bulbs in this Mandelbrot. There's junction points, so-called Misharevich points. There's the limits of these bulbs, the Feigenbaum points. There's many, many other kinds of points here for which the same sort of results hold. So just computing around these bulbs gives you some results, but not all. Good.
These rays that you draw remind me of a diagram that I've seen referred to as the major theorem in algebra. The real imaginary parts are called the real. The boundaries of those being zero should cross the line. So, there's another theorem about if you take a power series and you take partial sums of the power series, that the zeros should be the accumulation points to them.
I don't know about with the fundamental theorem of algebra, but the easy answer is no. Then I don't have to think. But I think each of these bulbs is given by some analytic function, right? Converges in that region, so diverges on the boundary. So convergence of the corresponding power series works in the interior and diverges everywhere else. But I don't think that's ever helped anyone prove anything about any of the structure of the Mandelbrot set, to the best of my knowledge. Okay.
Thank you. Which
Yeah, let me just show you that. I mean, it's a little bit harder to talk about. Here's the one-third bulb, and there's a baby Mandelbrot set there. Now, you're walking down the street, and I show you this baby Mandelbrot set. Could you tell me that came from the one-third bulb? Well, look at it. It's kind of hard to see, but there's all kinds of antennas coming off here. Much more so than the regular Mandelbrot set. You can almost see the period one-half bulb there, the one-third bulb here. But it's got much longer spokes. See it? But you don't see them. There's a long, thin filament of black. But if you take the color code going from, you know, red to orange to yellow to green, you can see this green spoke here. And notice that this green spoke has junction points with two things coming off it. Everywhere you look, there's junction points with two things coming off it. Everywhere you look, there's junction points with two things coming off it. That tells me that this baby Mandelbrot set is attached to a something over three bulb. And by looking at the orientation of which is the largest and which is the smallest, you can tell that this is the one-third bulb. And if you go to any other baby Mandelbrot set, I don't think I have any saved here, you'll see exactly the same phenomenon. All right, here's the two-fifths bulb. Oh, wait a minute. Here's the two-fifths bulb. Look at this baby Mandelbrot set here. Take a moment to cook. But now you see this baby Mandelbrot set? All kinds of crazy antennas sticking off it. But each one of them has a junction point with five spokes. And if you look, it's the two-fifths one that's the smallest. Right? It's the two-fifths one that's the smallest. Not this one, because that isn't the... It's the two-fifths that's the smallest. I'd have to count a different way in this one here. But just by looking at it, I see five. And by standing back and analyzing it further, you could see two-fifths and tell me that this was hanging directly off the two-fifths baby Mandelbrot. And then now you zoom in on this Mandelbrot set right here. It's a sub-Mandelbrot set to some kind of Mandelbrot set hanging off the two-fifths bulb. Its antenna would tell you exactly that. You'd see two-fifths and some other fraction there. That's why I say every little piece of the Mandelbrot set is effectively determined. You need good eyeglasses to see that, or better yet, the Riemann mapping theorem. But you can. Okay.
For this question, I'd like to ask the problem again for this last talk.